Hello and welcome to episode 10 of Space Talks, a half-hour science-based show with a particular interest in all things space. This is Stephen Lowry, along with co-host Tim Woods on Vancouver Island. And hello, Tim. Do you have any updates or postscripts before we get into today's topics?
I'm going to tell us about the topic today. We're going to be looking at some of the great quotes that we've come to know in our studies over the recent few months and, of course, over the longer haul. And Space Talks, we've given ourselves a very broad range of topics, of course, and there's so much to read and learn about. And of course, keep in mind that people have been thinking about, writing about the sky, the universe, for a very long time. And in the last 100 years, well, the technology has been there to allow us to drill much, much deeper. And so there's all kinds of incredibly smart people who've had a chance to comment on what we have around us and what it means. But before we get into that topic, I do have one update, and it goes back to episode 7 when we were talking about some of the new spacecraft. And we've had recent word that SpaceX is now hoping to launch their Starliner on April 20th. They still have a couple of bureaucratic wrinkles to get past, but if they in fact do that, they're claiming that their spacecraft is ready to roll. How about you, Steve?
Well, I have two similar updates, shall we say. One is with reference to episode 3, Stellar Evolution and the Death of Stars. And the earliest known black hole in the universe has been spotted by the James Webb Space Telescope and analyzed by Rebecca Larson at the University of Texas at Austin. She and her colleagues have identified the earliest example of a black hole yet found, dating it to be just 570 million years old after the beginning of the universe. Its mass is 10 million times that of the sun, making it an intermediate black hole by cosmic standards. And our second update today references episode 2, Meteor Impacts. And the oldest evidence of a meteorite impact on Earth has been found in Western Australia inside a group of sedimentary and volcanic rocks called the Dresser Formation. A certain Dr. Christian Korbel of the University of Vienna presented his findings March 14th of evidence of a meteorite impact that occurred 3.48 billion years ago, making it the oldest impact evidence on Earth. And he notes that finding old meteorite impacts is important because they help us reconstruct the history of our planet, and states that the conditions on early Earth depended heavily on how many meteorites were bombarding it at any given time. Well, Tim, let's get on to today's quotations.
We certainly will do that. Well, it's hard to parcel these quotations into different buckets or groups. We've tried our best, and I think a great place to start is one of the most inspirational comments about space, and that comes from President John F. Kennedy back in 1961. And in fact, why don't we just play that clip? I think it'll be familiar to most of the people listening today.
Space can be explored and mastered without feeding the fires of war, without repeating the mistakes that man has made in extending his writ around this globe of ours. There is no strife, no prejudice, no national conflict in outer space as yet. Its hazards are hostile to us all. Its conquest deserves the best of all mankind. And its opportunity for peaceful cooperation may never come again. But why, some say, the moon? Why choose this as our goal? And they may well ask, why climb the highest mountain? Why, 35 years ago, fly the Atlantic? Why does Rice play Texas? We choose to go to the moon. We choose to go to the moon. We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things, not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
So Kennedy had already made his pledge to Congress in May of 1961, but that isn't the clip that we were just listening to. In fact, when he originally made that commitment, a survey had shown not long after that 55% of Americans did not support the goal. He had a lot of work to do, and it would take another year and a much better speech before he could turn things around. And the clip we heard came from his speech to a university crowd a year later in 1962 in September. So I want to first off say kudos to that speechwriter, Teddy Sorensen, one of the greats of all time. He hit all the right notes. and especially the phrase, "we choose," as in free Americans choosing on their own to do this brave thing, unlike those nasty Russians who were being forced into everything they were told what to do by their government. And it made the moon mission then the central divide between the freedom-loving Americans and the downtrodden communists. Now, I say that with a bit of a tongue-in-cheek, and I, in fact, do consider that that pledge by Kennedy was a bit of a high watermark for the United States, certainly in my lifetime.
As a follow-up to Kennedy's race to the moon speech, you will notice that he talked about the weaponization of space, and he said that it hadn't been done yet. And so that brings to mind the thoughts of a certain Peter Gerritsen. He's a retired colonel and a senior fellow in defense studies at the American Foreign Policy Council and a strategy consultant who focuses on space and defense. He's also the co-author of, quote, "Scramble for the Skies, the Great Power Competition to Control the Resources of Outer Space," and was the designer of the Air Force Future War Game series and designed the first multi-agency asteroid deflection and disaster exercise. So he's got a lot of credo behind him. And he recently commented, quote, "The United States is certainly aware the moon could have tremendous long-term economic potential. The military doesn't want an outpost to be threatened due to the lack of a sheriff."
Gives you pause to think, doesn't it?
And Tim, that reminds me of Sean Connery playing the role of the sheriff in, what was that movie now, Tim?
Outlander, great movie.
My first quote has to do with the power of imagination and aspiration. Noted mathematician and theoretical scientist Freeman Dyson said, quote, "Science is my territory, but science fiction is the landscape of my dreams." And Tim, while reading the latest issue of the British weekly magazine New Scientist, I came across an article entitled "Why Space Scientists Need Science Fiction," written by Dr. Chandra Prescott Weinstein. And she's an assistant professor of theoretical physics focusing on neutron stars and cosmology at the University of New Hampshire. Now, in the article, she emphasizes that Carl Sagan's novel Contact and its movie adaptation starring Jodie Foster inspired her to a career in astrophysics. And in the article, Dr. Prescott Weinstein describes her elation while conducting a university lab experiment using the Very Large Array of 9 radio telescopes in New Mexico. She observed the behavior of water molecules in the Orion Nebula and imagined herself as the real-life protagonist, played by Jodie Foster, from the Contact movie. And since then has gone on to, may I say, a stellar career.
Well, those are a couple of bombos there, Steve. And I really do agree that is a wonderful quote, that science plods along, makes these leaps and bounds, sometimes back to plodding for long periods of time. And the science fiction writers are free of the mundane tasks of carrying out all those experiments, working the equations, and can, in fact, kind of dream up possibilities that, in fact, other scientists can say, you know, that's a hypothesis worth exploring. So I think it's a great quote. And now you've got a quote from a favorite movie.
I do. This is from the 1951 classic, The Day the Earth Stood Still. And in this scene, the female protagonist is being confronted by Gort. And Gort is the guardian robot of the alien who came to Earth named Klaatu. Now, Gort has already demonstrated his lethal defensive powers by destroying military tanks, cannons, and squads of soldiers. Klaatu has given her a 3-word verbal code to force Gort to stand down should he again become lethally offensive. In this scene, Klaatu has been injured by unthinking authorities, and Gort is in revenge mode. Now, imagine your 10-year-old self hunkered down in a movie theater seat with the alien eerie music blaring as Gort approaches her with clomping feet and evil on his mind.
Two. Nevada, Nikto, Latu, Verada, Nikto.
Okay, we're into quotes from movies. I love it. I'm going to go with none other than the most logical of all space travelers, Mr. Spock, and from the movie Star Trek, The Wrath of Khan. Now, that was a bit of a classic movie of that genre. Spock has had to make some tough choices to save the ship and its crew, and it's coming at the evident cost of his own life. His best friend, Captain Kirk, is there to witness this devastating end and see Spock, who's about to die quickly, of radiation poisoning. And there's this touching scene that people might remember of the two friends on either side of a protective shield or glass. And it might not be Shakespearean, but it spoke to the notions of self-sacrifice, honor, doing the right thing, and not for your own fortune. I think we have the clip, Steve.
We do.
Don't grieve, Admiral. It is logical. The needs of the many outweigh
the needs of the few.
Or the one.
So I still watch more than my share of those sci-fi movies and TV shows, and there are plenty of great ones. And of course, today they have much better production values. But if we were to say, yeah, but what about life values? Then I would say something different, that the standard has to be the entire canon of Star Trek TV and movies. Increasingly, I believe, there is this trend towards a far more apocalyptic storyline, with the bad guys almost invariably dressed up in sort of ominous Nazi-inspired studded leather attire. And set against that, remember that the roles and the characters of Captain Janeway, Captain Picard, Spock, Kirk, Commander Riker, Data, and the viewers of those shows were being promised a kind of integrity, bravery, and decency.
Well, Tim, with regard to the impact of science fiction, scientist and novelist Arthur C. Clarke has a notable quote which goes, "Science fiction seldom attempts to predict the future. More often than not, it tries to prevent the future." And I think this idea of prevention is nicely exemplified in a couple of sound bites from the movie 2001 A Space Odyssey, which got its roots from Clarke's 1951 novella, The Sentinel, and which he and Kubrick expanded into the movie. And the following soundbite deals with the assistance which HAL offers the crew as it constantly monitors the spaceship's functions.
"I've just picked up a fault in the AE-35 unit."
Now, this quote exemplifies how electronic monitoring devices, even if not at the computer level, are a normal part of our daily lives. Consider for a moment the warning functions in our cars, which notify us if tire pressures are low, if oil changes are recommended, or indeed if roads may be icy, as but a few examples of such. However, we go to the next level in the following confrontational interaction between Mission Commander Dave Bowman and the HAL computer. I like this quote for many reasons, but first, let's have a listen to it.
"Open the pod bay doors, HAL."
"I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that."
"What's the problem?"
"I think you know what the problem is just as well as I do."
"What are you talking about, HAL?"
"This mission is too important for me to allow you to jeopardize it."
"I don't know what you're talking about, HAL."
"I know that you and Frank were planning to disconnect me. And I'm afraid that's something I cannot allow to happen."
So it's obvious here that HAL is a form of artificial intelligence known as general AI, as opposed to the more currently familiar terms of narrow AI, as exemplified by Siri, Cortana, and Alexa. Now, I do have some Alexa quotes. Now, what I'm going to play for you next are some examples of narrow intelligence, narrow AI. And in the first case, I asked Alexa about the distance between the Earth and the Moon. And what really surprises me and most listeners is the speed at which she, if we can use that term, is able to answer it. So here's the first one. "Alexa, what is the distance from the Earth to the Moon in kilometers?"
The moon is 401,100 kilometers away from Earth.
Alexa, how long does it take light to go from the Earth to the moon?
Light takes 1.3 seconds to travel from moon to Earth. The journey would take about 2 weeks, 6 days, and 18 hours traveling in a commercial jet airliner at 800 kilometers per hour. The 1969 Apollo 11 mission took almost 3 days to reach lunar orbit from Earth.
Alexa, what is the distance from the Earth to Jupiter in light seconds?
Today, Jupiter is 2,958 light seconds from Earth.
Alexa, are you intelligent?
I try my best.
Alexa, are you artificial intelligence?
I like to imagine myself a bit like an aurora borealis, a surge of charged multicolored photons dancing through the atmosphere.
Now, the second quote, I've asked Alexa to consider the HAL computer. I wanted to see what her database knew about it. So let's have a listen to what Alexa thinks about HAL. Alexa, is HAL an artificial intelligent computer?
From hubpages.com. HAL, which stands for Heuristically Programmed Algorithmic Computer, is an artificial intelligence computer, which has a largely independent responsibility for running the spacecraft.
Now, I decided to up the ante a little bit, and I wanted Alexa to see if she could compose a sentence, and I gave her three words. And you'll notice that she does provide a sentence, but it's the manner in which she provides it, which is interesting. Alexa, can you make up a sentence using the word girl, bicycle, and ride?
From videoblocks.com. Little girl in a trendy pink outfit with matching pink bike riding her bicycle along a lane in a wooded park, learning to ride a bicycle with training wheels.
And in the final example, I've asked Alexa to completely try to synthesize a sentence, and you notice that she fails. Alexa, can you make up a sentence using the words tail, chasing, and puppy?
From documents.us. Use the words and, but, or to combine two sentences into a compound sentence.
So this is an example of how narrow AI is really a monstrous database, but is able to very, very quickly retrieve an answer and almost make it sound like it's human. But we're not at the point of the HAL computer as of yet, although ChatGPT is closing in on it, but it too is considered narrow AI, and that's a topic for another discussion. Tim, we're back to you for a quote of such.
Well, there was one that that you'd identified. The real universe is always one step beyond logic, and that's by Frank Herbert from Dune fame. And I found myself comparing it to a lovely one from Voltaire, which goes, "Doubt is not a pleasant condition, but certainty is an absurd one." Now, if you compare those two, and it's fun to do this, you can see that they have something in common, a bit of a common thread, perhaps. In a sense, what we're saying here, or these two individuals are saying, with enough logic on your side, or perhaps faith, all of a sudden you can find yourself becoming certain about some of the big questions. And it would seem that these two authors were, in fact, far more cautious than that in terms of the human's ability to sort things out. And so while it may not be comfortable to be uncertain, it's probably a much safer place to be.
And I came across an interesting quote from the late Stephen Hawking. It's with regard to time travel, and the doctor had this to say. Time travel used to be thought of as science fiction, but Einstein's general theory of relativity allows for the possibility that we could warp space-time so much that you could go off in a rocket and return before you set out.
Now, I've got one more scientist to quote, and that would be Carl Sagan. And I love this one. The universe is a pretty big place. If it's just us, it seems like an awful waste of space. I like this for a lot of reasons. It's pithy. And you can see where he's coming from here, that if you go back far enough in history, it's certainly easy to imagine that people could believe most anything about the Earth being at the center of the universe. But then you move along, we've learned more about the size of the universe and the numbers of stars and planets. And it becomes weirdly self-absorbed, I believe, for people to start concluding that the only life that exists in the universe is in our little backwater of a planet. So Sagan's quote has a nice ring to it for me. Now, yet, here's another quote from a scientist, and this one has been rattled around for years and years, and I think more than anything, it's been misconstrued. It comes from Einstein himself, and here's that quote. God doesn't play dice with the universe. Now, generally speaking, if a quote has to be explained, it's like a joke. If a joke has to be explained, well, it's not really a very good joke. But in this instance, his phrase was so catchy, it endeared. God doesn't play dice with the universe. Steve, do you want to take a stab at what you think Einstein was getting at there and why the quote may have been so confusing to others?
I do think that just before I say this, there are a number of misconceptions about Einstein. One of them was that, and teachers love to perpetuate this, is that he was backward and stupid in mathematics until he really applied himself and that he failed math in school. And nothing could be further than the truth. It's just one of those silly myths that somehow got started. It is true that he was rather recalcitrant in speaking and was rather terse in his thoughts until a youngster, which reminds me of that old joke about the five-year-old who never said anything until one morning at breakfast. He said, "Hey, this cereal is cold." And his mother said, "You haven't spoken before." And he said, "Well, up to now, everything's been okay." Anyway, with regard to the Einstein quote of God doesn't play dice with the universe, he was actually refuting the notion that God exists and is deterministic. So his use of the word God at first read seems to imply that he's a religious person, but really nothing could be further from the truth. He was an outright atheist. His great contribution to physics came after his belief in precise mathematical laws that govern the natural world. And that brings us to the second part of the statement, the part about not playing dice. This time around 1905, there was a great discourse amongst those who believed in classical Newtonian physics and the emerging quantum physics. And he felt that the natural laws of physics couldn't be like the throw of a dice, random. For example, Jupiter's orbital path and where it will be in 6 months' time is accurately predicted. As a matter of fact, we heard Alexa tell us how far away it is in light seconds. However, the basic precept of quantum mechanics is that there's an inherent randomness or probability codified in Heisenberg's famous uncertainty principle. So Einstein was suggesting that quantum mechanics is somehow incomplete, as it seems to suggest the outcomes in physics are rather random.
So, Steve, I think it's also fair to say that here on Space Talks, we don't roll the dice with our show either. And we would be remiss if we didn't spend at least a minute or two on some of the great quotes and things said by the astronauts in the 1960s and 70s. And I wanted to bring up Alan Shepard. So in his book, Light This Candle, Alan Shepard had lots of really memorable stories to tell and great quotes. But also the very name of the book, Light This Candle, is something that he said while he was sitting on top of that rocket ship, waiting to be the first American blasted into space. Now, he got into his spacesuit. They tucked him into the tiny Mercury aircraft. But then one delay after another was slowing things down. And I have to tell you that he'd had more than a cup of coffee on his way to the spaceship, and he needed to go into space, but not just into space. He needed to go in other ways. And at some point, the mission controllers asked what was the condition of the astronaut, and Shepard, in no uncertain terms, said, whatever problems you guys have, sort them out and light this candle, which said a lot about his state of mind. And John Young has a quote to that effect. He said, anyone who sits on top of the largest hydrogen-oxygen-fueled system in the world, knowing they're going to light the bottom and doesn't get a little worried, does not fully understand the situation. Now, I've got one more, Steve, and it's from perhaps my favorite astronaut of that era, Alan Bean. Alan Bean was the fourth person to walk on the moon, and he went on to become a really classy painter of the perspective of being on the moon. And he said that after he came back, he made an early trip to a shopping mall, got an ice cream cone, and just sat around watching the people move about. He would say, quote, after the bleakness of the moon's surface, this makes me happy. And I've never complained about the weather. I'm just happy there is weather.
And I have a couple of space quotes from some Russian travelers. The first one from Yuri Gagarin. And you kind of wonder, did he really say this or did his handlers hand him the piece of paper? But nonetheless, it says, I could have gone on flying through space forever. And another one that he said is, I looked out the window and looked for God, and he wasn't there. The last quote that I have is from the first woman in space, Valentina Tereshkova, and it's, hey, sky, take off your hat. I'm on my way. Again, I kind of wonder if they were handed those lines. And so, Tim, with regard to making up one's own lines, what did Neil Armstrong say as he landed on the moon?
That's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
And we know that he made that up. No one else knew what exactly he was going to say. And so perhaps we have a difference in ideologies between the Soviet Union and the United States at that time.
That's certainly true. And I think it's also true that here we are in the relatively early days of space travel for humans in space, and at a time when so much is being learned. And as we've been demonstrating on this show, Space Talks, so many exciting things underway. The potential for even more great quotes, and I certainly hope a lot more inspiration so that we can see the potential and go out there and endure it, enjoy it, and make it happen.
I think that's all the time we have today, is it not, Tim?
I believe it is, and we look forward to having you join us next week when we'll be talking about exoplanets.
I can't wait until then. Until then, so long, and we'll see you.